My fellow Americans and all those listening overseas, welcome back to Visiting the Presidents. I'm your host, Joe Fakush, and today we are on the road back to Quincy and United First Parish Church, the Church of the Presidents, and the gravesite of John Adams, second president of the United States. Now, before we go too far, I always want to remind you to check out visitingthepresidents.com, where you can find previous episodes, links to associated readings for the presidential sites, my photos from various trips, recommended readings, and so much more. You can also follow along on the social media profiles at Visiting the Presidents on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where I provide additional content throughout the week. Liking and commenting helps to raise the profile, and I appreciate any of you who've written a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You'll also find a link to help support Visiting the Presidents through PayPal. Your support helps to fund the production, editing, and hosting of Visiting the Presidents episodes and the website, as well as future trips and books. All support is greatly appreciated, but at the top of the Mount Rushmore of giving is Sammy and Tom Fakush, Nancy and Terry Workamp, Debbie and Dennis Fakush, Harvey and Casey Hyman, Connie and Adam Locke, Brittany and Keith Mellon, Stephanie Gaskill, and Andrew Alexander. Also, Jim and Catherine Hyman, Gail Rittenhouse, Sean and Liz Jones, Stephen Gilroy, Kurt Dion, Alexis Mira, April McKenzie, Matt and Megan Hochstetler, Caitlin Cahalan, Jim and Laurel Brayler, Eric Engartner, Patricia Argentina, Kara Steiner, Jamie and Ted Wilson, Candy and Ben Phelps, Lana Demers, and Craig Hunter, Kenneth Robinson, Thomas Kalina, Kristen and Steve Wendell, and Alex Syker. Thank you all so much. I also recommend that you go back and listen to the previous season's episodes on each president. For John Adams, check out Season 1's John Adams and Braintree, and Season 2's John Adams and Peacefield, and we'll pick up the action right where we left off. Now, I do want to mention, some of you who follow my social media will know that I did something to my back, so if I sounded all different, I'm in a lot of pain right now. I'm hoping it goes away, and I'm hoping I can, you know, recover pretty quickly, but I am in bad shape as we speak, and so definitely gives me a lot of sympathy for all of the president's maladies that we talk about in this season, for sure. Now, where we had left off with John Adams, he had been heavily criticized by his now Republican nemesis for what was called the XYZ affair, and then the fallout from the French War, with many Americans anticipating an impossible invasion, and George Washington being called out of retirement to be on standby should the army need to be mobilized. Adams then upset many of his critics with signing what was called the Alien and Sedition Acts, aimed at suppressing foreign sabotage, but also framed as the paranoid moves of an unpopular leader, and that he would be too thin-skinned to handle the overt criticism that he was experiencing. As his presidency continued, Adams became increasingly alienated from his vice president and now estranged friend, Thomas Jefferson, only adding to the loneliness of the office and his feelings of persecution. Those acts expired in 1800, but they delivered Adams's Republican critics a political gift, portrayed as the unconstitutional suspension of freedom of the speech and the press that the founders had sought to enshrine. Historian John Furling wrote about how irritable the already massively irritated John Adams had become. He and Abigail had split half of their years in Philadelphia and the other half in Quincy, preparing their new estate, but he snapped at her and everyone around him for those last two summers. This was all really weighing on him. Now, to look at the end of John Adams's presidency, it's important to point out he's our first president to lose a presidential election. And while today we think nothing of a Donald Trump losing an election and having to leave the White House, this was the first time this would ever happen. And you can imagine the kind of humiliation that would accompany a person like John Adams, who already felt like he wasn't measuring up to George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, and then to have this ignominious title attached to him as well. John Adams, like I said, would be our first president to face a true opponent in his re-election, and the only president to square off against his vice president and ex-intimate friend Thomas Jefferson. While the two had faced off previously in 1796 and they were able to work together as president and vice president, Jefferson made clear that he would not serve as Adams's vice president again, and Adams was not going to do the same thing. He could not countenance the opportunity to serve as vice president for another founder that he thought was lacking in his own talents. Both Adams and Jefferson identified partisans who could serve as their running mate, and Thomas Jefferson and his running mate Aaron Burr won an early victory when the New York legislature turned from Federalist to Republican, signaling the victory for Jefferson and Burr. Remember that in this period, there was no set election day, and the states determined how their legislators chose their electors, so Adams saw plenty of early signs that the tides were turning against the Federalists. Late in the summer of 1800s, as states were choosing their electors, Alexander Hamilton damaged both of their reputations with the publishing of an attempted expose portraying portraying Adams as deranged, but this ended up being only one of several such denouncements. The Aurora called him old, querulous, bald, blind, crippled, toothless Adams. In season 2's Thomas Jefferson episode, we discussed the drama between that ticket, and there was also a coordinated effort between the two factions, with Jefferson's election being accompanied, as one flyer warned, by murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest being taught and practiced. President Adams did not campaign. He made a trip to Baltimore in the new government district that'll be known as Washington, D.C., that some cast as political electioneering, but Adams refrained from overt speechmaking or any kind of glad-handing. He thought it was beneath him and the office of the presidency, but he also didn't believe that he personally had anything to prove. Just as in 1789, Adams believed his resume was untouchable. President Adams was, of course, then bitterly disappointed to not just lose the election, but actually finish in third place. And he was especially stung from being ousted by his former friend Jefferson. Abigail made no effort to hide her hatred of Alexander Hamilton and the role that splitting the Federalists might have played, but she also privately looked forward to a happier life settled back in Quincy. John took to calling himself John of Stonyfield, a name he started calling his Peacefield home. He put off calls from other Federalists to maybe appoint himself to the Supreme Court or to pursue being an ambassador in another embassy abroad. He had not been out of public service for over 35 years, and he had improvements to make to his property in Quincy and was rapidly losing his eyesight. But in truth, he was also just completely embarrassed and heartbroken over this defeat. Adding insult to the injury of losing the election, Adams learned of his defeat less than a month into being dislodged from Philadelphia to go to the new capital in the District of Columbia, and he and Abigail were severely underwhelmed by the conditions of the mansion, which was unable to heat properly and had not had plaster in most of the rooms. Abigail even left early for their Massachusetts home, leaving John alone in the unfinished mansion. Adams did compose his famous prayer in a letter to Abigail, writing, "I pray heaven to bestow the best of blessings on this house and all that shall hereafter inhabit it. May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof." Today, this is engraved on the mantelpiece in the state dining room. Before leaving the new mansion, however, Adams dealt the incoming Jefferson presidency a huge blow with what would become known as the Midnight Appointments, with Adams replacing as much of the judiciary as possible with young Federalist judges certain to thwart the agenda of the Jeffersonians. John Furling argued that this was a propaganda effort by the Jeffersonians and that Adams had been working on these appointments for over 2 weeks. It's important to also point out that this was only the second time that a presidency was changing hands at all, and the first to an opposition party. And Adams interpreted his actions as the duties of a president that he was going to work up until the day he had to leave. President Adams would not leave the executive mansion in the last few days of his presidency, and he did not put together a farewell address like Washington had done. Instead, his thoughts turned inward, and he prepared to depart for a quiet retirement. John Adams left the executive mansion in the early morning of Inauguration Day, 1801, the first of only four presidents to refuse to attend their successor's ceremony. Instead, Adams's cabinet officials escorted Jefferson into the Senate chamber to take the oath of office, and by then Adams was on the road to Quincy. Now, when we look at the post-presidency, we're talking about a man who will have 25 years, even now one of the longer post-presidencies passed by, you know, of course, Jimmy Carter, Herbert Hoover, Gerald Ford, but for the longest time, this was by far one of the longest post-presidencies, something that John Adams did not think he was going to have. Now, of course, he earned his legacy as a poor loser, and by the horrible act in refusing to attend Jefferson's inauguration, which we usually owe to his hurt feelings. His actions in trying to thwart the new president's policies with these appointments, thankfully, did not catch on as a new precedent. We won't see that kind of tactic being done too often. But one thing that's often ignored is that the Adamses were also deeply grieving. John and Abigail were, of course, difficult parents, as we discussed in season one, if you listen to John Quincy's episode, or if you listen to season two, where they are going to be very much expecting of their sons in particular, and they could be a real head trip in terms of that expectation. But the Adamses are also going to have a very difficult time with the two sons in particular. Abigail admonished John in a letter when he expressed envy that President George Washington had no children, and thus no children could cause him anguish. Abigail pointed out that there was no joy to be gained as well. She was nervous about their daughter's marriage that seemed to be at this point on the brink of disaster, but nothing could prepare them for their youngest son's descent into alcoholism. As president, John had renounced Charles the last time that he ever saw him, on a detour through New York in the summer of 1799, calling him a rake, a beast, and a madman possessed by the devil. He said he would never see him again, and he kept that promise. Abigail, however, stopped to see him on her way to join John in the new president's mansion in late 1800, and she found Charles on his deathbed. She was understandably unmoored by the sight of her youngest and by John's harsh words when Charles did pass, regardless of the hurt and loss that the feelings were rooted in. John got news of Charles's death only hours before the Electoral College met, and he said, "Nothing more is to be said." John did not mean this harsh remark. In fact, he found himself reminiscing about the time that he had spent with his young son in France and in Holland, and he did blame himself for the time he spent caught up in the nation's affairs, both in Philadelphia and throughout Europe, and for possibly abandoning his sons when they needed his guidance. He promised his son Thomas to spend more time with him. Now, John Adams was convinced that, like George Washington, he would survive only a few years. Consider that Adams's own father died at 70 and George Washington at 67. Instead, John Adams will live to 90, so an additional 20 years to what he thought he might have to look forward to. He wrote that when he turned 64, "I am old, old, very old, and I shall never be very well." He had by then lost most of his teeth and would not wear dentures, but he had all the aches and pains of a 60-year-old man. Instead of dying soon, however, as I said, he lives to over 25 years, remaining curious and abreast of American affairs. John and Abigail had purchased the beautiful home that they would name the Old House or Peacefield that we discussed in season 2, but his service as vice president and then president kept his ability to really tackle all of those renovations and preparations off until he was fully retired. Remember that in season 1, I talked about John telling his father when he was a young boy that he wanted to be a farmer. Now, in his retirement, he was able to get back to the land. He was one of the only early presidents not to be overwhelmed with debt in his dying days. At first, however, Adams is going to be in a deep funk, something closely resembling depression, where he sat in his library and stared out the window, seldom even leaving the house. There is no record of him leaving the Quincy estate for his first few years of his retirement, even to go to nearby Boston. Unlike Washington, who was inundated by constant visitors at Mount Vernon, the Adamses received none. As time went along, Adams became pretty bored, and he started working in his fields and then picking up his beloved books and pens. Adams loved reading new books and rereading some of his old favorites, even paying his grandchildren to read to him when his eyes developed cataract. As for writing, at first Adams was consumed only with correcting slander against him from the 1800 election. John Quincy had to beg his father to write his recollections of the history that he had witnessed, but John begged off in the, quote, mortifications, disappointments, and resentments that they were sure to stir up. He started writing anyway, but the results are somewhat lackluster, with Adams's organization being all over the map, and he focuses on some of the things you wish he hadn't, and then doesn't focus on things that we think might be more important, with only cursory attention to some of the really juicy moments and people that he had been witness to. Adams began to fall out with his Federalist Party ideology, and he quietly identified more with the new brand of Democratic Republican that his son was becoming a leader of. John Quincy's burgeoning career did temper some of Adams's writing. He didn't want to publish anything salacious that might reflect poorly on John Quincy. But a high-profile falling out with former friend Mercy Warren over her account in the, quote, history of the rise, progress, and termination of the American Revolution led Adams to begin picking up the pen again, this time in regular essays in the Boston Patriot to defend his thinking and actions. In truth, it also helped to purge some of his resentments and anger. In 1805, John began corresponding with Benjamin Rush, who he had fallen out with, and came to write 2 or 3 letters a week, devoting hours to what he would write and opine on, sometimes philosophy, theology, and of course, the current political scene. They wrote regularly through Rush's death in 1813, and it was Rush who would convince Adams to begin writing to Thomas Jefferson again. Adams had written to Jefferson early in his presidency, but Jefferson was likely busy with other matters and they went unanswered, which of course Adams read as an insult. Jefferson did respond to Abigail's letters after Jefferson's daughter died, but they again went silent when she became more critical of his conduct in 1800. Benjamin Rush and John and Edward Coles, who were James Madison's secretaries who had gone by the Adamses in Quincy, all encouraged a detente between the two former friends, and Adams was then left to send the first letter. As noted previously, Adams threw himself into the correspondence, and he actually wrote 109 letters to Jefferson's 49 over the course of the next dozen years. In those letters, Adams sometimes tried to revisit old disagreements, but Jefferson will try to maintain a cordial and really kind of forward-thinking tone, and they largely covered philosophical, religious, and sometimes broadly political ideas. David McCullough made note that Thomas Jefferson wrote as if he was talking to an audience of the future, right? That these letters would be preserved and that other generations would get to do with them what they wanted. And that John was taking them much more as a way to chat with his friend and going from different topic to topic. And you also get the sense of somebody who was a bit lonely and not being able to share these deep conversations with them. That's probably what he missed most in. He said at one point, "I considered when I wrote to Mr. J that I was not writing psalms, nor sermons, nor prayers. It was only as if one sailor had met a brother sailor after 25 years absence and had accosted him, 'How fare you?'" And I think that's a lovely way to put what their conversation would be like at this point. They knew they would never see each other again. They would never have that opportunity to hang out and have a chaw the way that they had before. And that got kind of ripped from them as they dug into their politics. But here they were in their older years and able to record their ideas and thoughts. And John really wanted to kind of resume what had been an informal way of chatting with his friend. The disparity in the number of letters did not go unobserved by John Adams, who said at one point, "Never mind if I write four letters to your one. Your one is worth more than my four." Whether or not you believe him is up to you. An example of where John Adams tried to get into some serious topics, recalling what had happened in the 1790s and at the end of Adams's presidency. He said, "You and I ought not to die before we've explained ourselves to each other." And Jefferson says, "The summum bonum with me is now truly Epicurean, ease of body and tranquility of mind, and to those I wish to consign my remaining days." After that, there were really no other big attempts, but we will talk next week about how Thomas approached his retirement in a different way than John Adams did. There were certain things the two of them didn't go into. For instance, Thomas Jefferson never writes about all of the different things he's doing, including building Poplar Forest, his relationships on the plantation, including with Sally Hemings. There's so much that he kind of keeps at a surface level. And John's much the same. But it is clear the esteem that John held Thomas at one point, saying that Thomas lived at Monticello, and John started saying that he lived at Montezillo as a way to say, like, my little kind of ode to Thomas Jefferson. John Ferling noted that later in his letters, John took from signing off with sincere esteem to towards the end saying, "with half a century's affection for yourself." And in another saying, "every line from you exhilarates my spirits and gives me a glow of pleasure." John Ferling wrote that in responding to his correspondence, Adams may have felt that Jefferson was elevating him to the same status, that rather than being looked down on, buried, despised, or banished, Jefferson is holding him in the same high esteem that Adams had once held him. Adams, of course, will be delighted when John Quincy will be elevated from the state legislature to becoming a U.S. senator and then to become ambassador to Russia, even if that meant that when they said goodbye, he thought he might never see his son again, given his and Abigail's health. When John Quincy comes back to serve as Secretary of State under James Monroe, he found both of his parents looking pretty old. John, in fact, called himself an old dotard and compared himself to the way he had viewed Benjamin Franklin in Paris in the 1780s. Now, Abigail's health had deteriorated in their retirement. She had a bout of influenza in 1807 and then dysentery in 1809 and then had a pulmonary disorder that often left her unable to speak. She began taking opium and purgatives, but sometimes was confined to bed for days on end. John and Abigail were delighted to be visited by John Quincy's children frequently, with all of them studying in Boston. But it became so much for the elderly couple that at one point they had to ask them to scale back their visits. And if you're a grandparent, you probably know that this could be the case. In 1818, Abigail caught typhoid fever early in the autumn. And though she had rallied for a time, she was severely weakened, and she passed away on October 8, 1818, at 74 years old. John had expected to outlive her. He was 9 years older than her, and so this will send him into kind of a tailspin. He walked the half mile to the church for her funeral service, and there the pallbearers will include the governor of Massachusetts and the president of Harvard College. At first, Abigail will be buried beside their daughter, Nabby. John became a presidential elector in 1820 and returned to the Massachusetts State Constitutional Convention. He did complain, however, that he was not as productive at the Constitutional Convention as he wished he could have been, and so he'll start to kind of draw back from his public appearances. Remember, he'll beg whoever will read to him to read some of his favorite books, maybe for the last time, including from James Fenimore Cooper and Lord Byron, and he says, "I'll even listen to some sermons." He dictated the letters that he signed now, but John Ferling notes how atrociously whoever wrote for him would spell. Thomas Cushing's last name became Cushion, like a seat cushion. John Marshall's last name became Marshall, like martial law. And Negroes would be spelled N-E and then G-R-O-W-S. Now, that isn't to say that there were never any visitors. John was very excited to have President James Monroe come through Boston in the summer of 1817 when he was on a northern tour, much like George Washington's, and he made the trip out to Peacefield and visited with John and Abigail. And John was very gratified just not to have been forgotten and that this was putting him in that esteem. A few years later, when the Marquis de Lafayette came for his return to America, he stopped in Boston, and there was a letter from John Adams saying, "I wish I could have come out to see you here, but I'm in such bad shape. It would be nice if you could come out and visit me at Peacefield." And the Marquis did come out, and so they had a very nice visit. Finally, in 1824, John will be the first of only two presidents to see his son elected as president, and Jefferson will note the pride that Adams must have felt over the election, but you're likely aware of the quote from John Adams where he said, "Any man who served that office would never wish that upon a friend," and in this case, a son. We'll turn next to the death of John Adams, which I know as a spoiler, it's not going to be as exciting as the death of George Washington, who was to many in the prime of his life at 67. John Adams will be 90, having outlived his wife, all of the friends that he knew when he was younger, all of the signers of the Declaration, including Thomas Jefferson earlier that day, you're aware, and only Charles Carroll of Carrollton surviving even the two of them. But by and large, John was feeling pretty lonely. He was pretty healthy, such as it was into his and now 90s. Throughout his retirement, he suffered a palsy early in his vice presidency, and that worsened as he aged, as did his eyesight. But he was riding his horses regularly and walked up to 4 miles around his property daily. Adams did smoke through the rest of his life, but he drank less as he aged, and he made himself sleep more. He wrote that he took mercury and bark, don't ask me why, and then would eat what he called Indian porridge, water gruel, and mutton broth. And if that's what it takes to live to 90, I'm okay checking out early. Adams began suffering from boils, which, no thank you, aching joints, and then general fatigue, as well as feeling like he was constantly having a cold. He was also, of course, heartbroken much of the time, missing Abigail, but also, as I said, having survived all of his peers and friends, with the one exception of Jefferson. When finally his brother died, Adams officially outlived both of his parents, and he knew death could not be far off, but wanted to reach the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence being signed. His health flagged as the anniversary approached. Doctors found him to be disinterested in general conversation and unable to swallow for that last year of his life, and Adams was confined mainly to his upstairs bedroom and unable to leave the house. The doctors believed he wouldn't survive the spring of 1826, but he's still ticking in the summer and is trying to make it to July the 4th. He does tell the people who are planning a big celebration in Boston that he's not going to be able to make it, but a local delegation comes to him on June the 30th to see if he has a message to pass on, and he replies loudly, "Independence forever." The next day, he could barely talk, and his health will continue to fail over the next 2 days. He falls into what we would consider kind of a coma, but wakes up early on July the 4th to say, "It's a great and glorious day," at the excitement of the holiday. He then fell again into a coma and rallied just after noon to say, "Thomas Jefferson still, we say survived, some say lived, but the word is debated." A short time later, he'll say, "Help me, child, help me," to his granddaughter. But just before sunset, he will stop breathing. As I said, John Adams was 90, and until Herbert Hoover, will be the oldest president ever. And he dies on July the 4th, 1826. He is going to be passed down the road by Ronald Reagan, Gerald Ford, George H.W. Bush, and of course, Jimmy Carter, who is still with us at 99 at the time of recording. Of course, as you know, and what that we'll uncover next episode, Thomas Jefferson had also passed hours before, the only time that two presidents have died on the exact same day. The National Park Service is unsure if Adams died in his study or in the guest bedroom, but you can visit both when you visit Peacefield. John's body will be kept on his bed without embalming until a coffin is brought to Peacefield on July the 5th. They then take the coffin downstairs in the parlor of his home while family and friends take turns staying with the body. A funeral is conducted on July the 7th, beginning at the Peacefield home and then processing to the First Congregational Church, with Harvard University's president and the governor among the pallbearers. Relatives of John Adams and the local societies were instructed to meet at the old house and process with the coffin, while the citizens of Quincy will be waiting at the town hall. When they go by the town hall, everybody comes together, and you have to imagine what a kind of emotional or striking image this would have been to see them all taking their most famous citizen to the church one last time. The citizens then allowed the visitors, pallbearers, dignitaries, and relatives to enter the church, where there will be a sermon over the verse from 1 Chronicles saying, "He died in a good old age, full of days and hours." John Quincy was still en route from Washington. In Philadelphia, he'll receive word that his father was already buried. On August the 2nd, President John Quincy Adams will attend a memorial pageant for Presidents John Adams and Thomas Jefferson held in the Massachusetts State House. There were funeral processions in many major cities where they paired the death of John Adams with his friend Thomas Jefferson. John left his home and 100 acres, as well as his books, to John Quincy, with some given to his other surviving son, as well as money for a new church and school. John Adams was initially buried in the old burial ground, now called Hancock Cemetery, beside Abigail Ann Nabby, while construction began for United First Parish Church, a congregational church in Quincy that John was very involved in, and had even given money to, with some money from his will being given there as well. The vault that John and Abigail were placed in, and that John Quincy would later be temporarily buried in, still stands in that cemetery. It just has John Quincy Adams over it. John Quincy quickly arranged for John and Abigail to be buried in the crypt of the church, an honor that was reserved for the elite back in England. In November 1826, the church accepted John Quincy's proposal to build a tomb for his parents, and he bore the expenses of the entombment. The church reserved a 14 by 14 foot space for the tombs of John and Abigail Adams, with granite coffins quarried from Quincy. 2 years after he died, in April of 1828, John and Abigail were moved into the crypt as the church was still being constructed. On top of each was a granite slab bearing only their names. John Quincy composed an epitaph for a stone that would sit beside the altar that you can read today. Beneath these walls are deposited the mortal remains of John Adams, son of John and Susanna Boylston Adams, second president of the United States. Born October 1735, on the 4th of July 1776, he pledged his life's fortune and sacred honor to the independence of his country. On the 3rd of September 1783, he affixed his seal to the definitive treaty with Great Britain, which acknowledged the independence and consummated the redemption of his pledge. On the 4th of July 1826, he was summoned to the independence of immortality and to the judgment of his God. This house will bear witness to his piety, this town, his birthplace, to his munificence, history to his patriotism, posterity to the depth and compass of his mind. In the crypt, the granite tomb reads simply John Adams, and he'll be joined by John Quincy and his wife Louisa in 1852. The Daughters of the American Revolution placed a marble plaque at the entrance that reads, "John Adams, signer of the Declaration of Independence, framer of the Constitution of Massachusetts, second president of the United States, 1735 to 1826. The crypt was sealed to the public, and the church and the resting place were in disrepair for a time. But in 1891, it will be decided to open the tombs to the public. But even then, the experience is not so great, and with a door and a gate obscuring a view of the crypt. Charles Francis Adams, grandson of John, will fund repairs made to make the site more visitor-friendly, including adding a protective iron grill and then electric lights inside. President William Howard Taft will be the first to visit the site, and Calvin Coolidge entered the crypt to pay his respect. Franklin Roosevelt went to the church but could not make it into the basement, while Harry Truman gave a speech on the steps. The site underwent a renovation in 1999, and it was placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1970. Now, you can visit across from the church in Hancock Cemetery, the main burial site for Quincy for two centuries, and where generations of the Adamses are interred, including John's parents. Abigail was buried in the vault where Nabby was, on the perimeter of the cemetery closest to the church. The tomb is built into the wall, and though it's crumbling now, the exterior is low to the ground and has brick with two small doors. The pediment reads J.Q. Adams, as this was intended to be John Quincy's permanent resting place until they move him into the crypt beside his parents. John and Abigail's daughter remains in the vault, along with two of John Quincy's sons. Now, in terms of what you'll find when you go to visit, it's important to note that they are restricted during certain months. And so if you want to go down into the crypt, for the most part, the visitor program at United First Parish Church is conducted from April the 17th until November the 11th. There is a suggested donation if you do go down into the crypt. It is wheelchair accessible. They're very proud of. And like I said, they do give a tour that starts in the sanctuary so you can see the two marble marble plaques that are put beside the altar for John and John Quincy and their wives, and then go down into the crypt. And you have to remember that when they were initially buried there, the thought wasn't that we would be going down into the crypt, but it's very cool that they let us do this and we're able to view the grave sites of two of our presidents. So when I have gone there, and I've done this two different times, the first time was in the summer of 2019 when I went to Boston and wanted to knock out as many of the presidential sites as I could. So you show up in the sanctuary and there they kind of give you a little bit of a highlights of the sanctuary, but also the church and then the lives of John and John Quincy. And you're able to take as many photos as you want. And so I got some great pictures of the two marble plaques, which have a bust of both men over each one of their plaques, and do give the appropriate amount of detail for both and, of course, their wives. And then you're led down into the crypt. And so there, on both visits, they had this cardboard cutout of John Adams beside a flag. And then you see the marble plaque outside of this grill. And then they open that up. It is locked when they're not showing it, and you're able to process inside. Now, when you go inside, the ceiling is very low. It's very simple. There's nothing adorning the walls. The only thing in there is the four granite tombs. You can tell which are the two that have John and John Quincy because they have an American flag on them. On my second visit, John Quincy's would have a wreath from his birthday, which was being celebrated very recently. And so that was the only kind of added embellishment. Now on the outside, you do get to see all four plaques that read John Adams, Abigail, John Quincy, and Louisa. And they do have some other items down in the crypt for visitors to get to see, including a model of the church and then other documents that they've uncovered, including a ledger that John actually wrote in. And so that part is very cool. Now, when I visited the first time, I was very impressed by how much you were able to see. And again, remember that gravesites were not always on my radar in terms of, you know, I really got to go to this place or I really want to see this. And so I didn't do too much research on what I would actually be able to see. And I was so impressed that they had so many items dedicated to both men that, you know, they really make a big point of it. I think in my mind, I thought it would be, you know, a very kind of creepy, dark, dank situation. And instead, it's a very well-maintained site with all sorts of different items to get to look at. And so I was very impressed and have been. I do recommend, you know, all those donations go back to help fund them remaining open and being able to be a part of it. Keep in mind, this is not in association with the National Park Service. They do offer you directions to the site, but it is privately maintained by the church. And so again, that's why the suggested donation. Now, one cool thing about my visit the first time was that my tour guide happened to be somebody that some of you might be aware of and is a big name in the presidential grave business, and that's Kurt Dion, who today is serving as education coordinator at the Congressional Cemetery in Washington, D.C., but back here was a volunteer at United First Parish Church, and you can read all about Kurt's exploits in his recent book, Presidential Grave Hunter, and then you can follow him on his social media profiles. But he gave a very detail, in-depth tour past the sanctuary and then going into the crypt. And that really is the meat of what you're going there to visit. There is a marker outside. There is also the cemetery right across the little pavilion that they have that you are able to go in and take the photos of the John Adams's parents and that kind of thing. But that's the majority of it. And so I do recommend if you're there to, you know, fit it in when you're going to the two birthplaces and the home. You can make a whole day of being in Quincy. And so getting the timing right can be, you know, tricky maybe, and making sure that all of the sites are open on the same days, which I did run into as an issue. My second visit came after the pandemic, and so they were just starting to reopen some of the different parts. My most recent visit was in the summer of 2022 to revisit the different presidential sites. Remember, I didn't take photos of myself in front of the graves on my first visit, and so this time I wanted to make sure I got that content. And so when I had gone the first day, you weren't able to go into the church. It was closed for some reason. And so I had to come back the next morning. And it was that important to me that I made sure I was there the second day and to be able to go inside. And so you do want to just double check that. My issue was, you know, again, there was a staggered opening. And so some days at the visitor center were open, the church wasn't, and vice versa. You know, again, it is always important for you to check the website. And so I will link to that here on the website page. Make sure you're paying attention to that. And going during those months, you know, the visitor center and the birthplaces and home are not open year round, and the church is not either. And so if you're there in the winter, I know of people who have been able to make arrangements to go inside, but I wouldn't want to chance it if I was planning a trip. Now, on the second visit, I was so much more kind of keyed into what I was going to get to see. And so I was trying to look out for those other details and things that I might have missed on the first one. And in the first visit, I did not go to Hancock Cemetery. This time I made a point of it, made sure to get my pictures of the church on the outside and all sorts of things that, again, I was just too kind of overwhelmed, I think, on that first visit. Do make sure that you're, again, planning ahead of time and check out my photos. I think that's a good place to get started and at least know what you're going to get into when you go inside. And so, great place to start. Now, in terms of the legacy of John Adams, he is going to have predicted, of course, that he's not going to have nearly the same level of celebration of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. And for a lot of our early history, he really did kind of fall into that obscurity. And there are some counties, we have 7 different counties in the United States, but some are named for him and his son. And so even then, you can see where he feels a little bit overshadowed. He's not get a capital city named after him or anything like that. There is plans to make a memorial to him. Now, when you go to Washington, D.C., and you see the giant Washington Monument and the big Thomas Jefferson Memorial or Abraham Lincoln Memorial, obviously, it's not going to be anything like that. And the plans are still in place. What exactly it will entail is one of those that I think will be really keyed in to see what gets included. It's right now planned to be dedicated to the Adamses as a whole. So not just John on his own, but after reading so much about John and Abigail and then John Quincy, I think you do understand why they want to make sure that it's more encompassing and inclusive. But if it will be on the mall is unclear. There are currently restrictions against adding anything else there. There's nothing else to be added to the tidal basin, so even the location will be a bit trickier. In terms of finding statues of John Adams, they're again not as plentiful as with George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, but there are ones in Quincy and then one at Harvard. So there are going to be those tributes. One thing I will say, though, is his depiction in media, where you are likely familiar with the miniseries that HBO produced during Paul Giamatti and Laura Linney as John and Abigail from 2007 that I watched. I mean, it's been 2 times this year, but I watch pretty frequently and it's so well done that I definitely recommend you to watch that and then read the accompanying books. And I'll talk about David McCullough's in a second, but that is going to be the big recommendation in terms of you getting an up close and personal view of John Adams throughout his incredible story and the events that he was able to see for himself. And of course, that inform our own kind of understanding of this era. Some of you might also be familiar with the musical 1776, where John Adams plays a pretty large role. Originally on the stage, it was done by William Daniels, who would later go on to play Mr. Feeny in Boy Meets World, which is how I first knew him. I remember a history teacher in high school would play the musical 1776 at least once a year. One of the funny stories that goes with that is that when William Daniels was nominated for a Tony in supporting, he said, John Adams is not a supporting character. And so he refused the nomination. So John Adams would be very proud in that moment. And so while he recognizes in his retirement that he's going to be overshadowed by Thomas Jefferson, you know, I do think that we give him a lot of attention now. And, you know, there is increased dialogue about the actions that Alexander Hamilton had in terms of the way that John Adams was portrayed. And so definitely something for us to be even more aware of as time goes along. You know, in terms of the way that John Adams is commemorated at his gravesite, I think it's important to recognize that just with his birth place and his home and his gravesite, that he's sharing it with his son. And that is a tribute to how much he really held John Quincy and his own accomplishments in esteem. One of the last communications that he had with George Washington was Washington telling him, you're going to want to appoint your son to a position. And I'm telling you, it is important that you do it, that you don't try to hold back because you think it's unfair or people will see it as some kind of nepotism. Your son's earned this. And that means more to John Adams than almost anything anybody will ever say positively. As much as he's very self-critical and lets other people's criticisms eat at him, the idea that he has done one thing kind of perfectly, and that's raise a future diplomat and, as we know, a future president. I think it is poetry that the two of them are buried together, that you get to see both of them, and that honor that John Quincy recognized, you know, that being buried in a church, obviously that they would be a bit more accessible than, as we talked about with George Washington, and we'll see with Thomas Jefferson, James Madison's gravesites, that, you know, you would have had to go to their respective estates. And in the case of John Adams, that he'll be in a church, and that represents, you know, the importance of the church to the Quincy and Puritan communities of New England, but also to John and his family. Now, when we come back next time, we will be looking into the death of Thomas Jefferson, which, spoiler alert, same day, right? July the 4th of 1826. But we'll be talking about his own post-presidency and the different items that Thomas Jefferson has. So you won't want to miss that as we talk about Thomas Jefferson's grave at Monticello. Now, when it comes to you reading on John Adams, I do highlight David McCullough's book, John Adams, which is kind of held up as the real gold standard and winner of the Pulitzer Prize. But I also strongly recommend John Ferling's book, John Adams, A Life, which I found just to be really engrossing and gives you a good sense of John Adams's own kind of writings and the way he might have felt as well. And so pairing those two books together is pretty good and gives you a good understanding of his post-presidency. And then, of course, Adams versus Jefferson, The Tumultuous Election of 1800, also by John Ferling, where he gets into their friendship and the way that they are first teammates, and then over time have this falling out, but towards the end of their life are able to come back together. And so all of those are strongly recommended. Remember to be checking out visitingthepresidents.com, where you can find previous episodes, links to associated readings for the presidential sites, my photos from various trips, recommended readings, and so much more. You can follow along on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for Visiting the Presidents, and then consider supporting Visiting the Presidents by writing a review or donating through PayPal. All season, I'm also bringing you content from William D. Gregorio's complete book of U.S. Presidents, Louis Picone's The President is Dead, and I also recommend Brady Carlson's Dead Presidents. And with that, I look forward to seeing you in a couple weeks when we go to Thomas Jefferson's grave at Monticello. And as always, I look forward to seeing you out there on the road as we continue to visit the presidents. See ya.